Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Anthony Campanella, Vice President for Intelligence Programs at CMX Technologies, a small defense consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. His topic will be the state of security in the heartland and beyond, assessing the homeland threat. Prior to joining CMX, Mr. Campanella provided consulting support to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Department of Defense Counterintelligence Field Agency, and the Department of Homeland Security, where he provided support to the Office of Intelligence and Analysis. Prior to entering the private sector, Mr. Campanella served as an intelligence officer with the Defense Intelligence Agency, coordinating national intelligence support to deployed military units. A former Marine, he served 6 years based out of Camp Lejeune, completing 3 NATO deployments to northern Norway and 2 6-month Mediterranean cruises aboard U.S. Navy ships. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday morning, September 11, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Bellevue University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now, speaking on the state of security in the heartland and beyond, is Anthony Campanella.
By a show of hands, can I see how many folks were here last year for the conference? Wow, very good number of people. I hope to be half as funny and, you know, a quarter as insightful as General Hughes was last year, because I thought his briefing last year was dead on, and he was able to convey a lot of things. But I'm going to talk about assessing the greater threat to the homeland, whether it is from Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda homegrown sympathizers. I can go through my disclaimers now. The views you hear today are mine and mine only. Although I currently consult to the Department of Defense, the views don't reflect the position of the Department of Defense, the U.S. government, or probably any other sane individual in the United States. They're mine and mine alone. I do work in a classified environment every day, so all of the material you're going to see here today was open source information. It was not gleaned from my work. As a matter of fact, I went out of my way to pick a subject area that is not something that I'm dealt with every day so that I wouldn't have that conflict of interest and possibly take information from a classified arena into an open source environment. And finally, if during the question and answer period, if somebody does ask a question that goes into my knowledge in the classified realm, I won't answer it at all. Don't take that as confirmation or denial of that fact. I just won't address it, and I'll let you know that I won't address it. It just keeps me employed, keeps me cleared, and keeps me out of jail, which is, you know, 3 things I'm eternally grateful for. So again, today's discussion topic will be on looking at the diminished influence of Al-Qaeda as far as operationally. However, their increased influence in motivating other individuals, like-minded individuals, sympathizers, to follow in their path and continue on their global goals. Again, what I'm going to go through today is some historical Al-Qaeda attacks, some Al-Qaeda-inspired attacks in Europe, some homegrown terrorist plots, talk a little bit about the radicalization process, how folks move from being a student at Bellevue University to a radicalized terrorist. Talk a little bit about this term that's being bandied around Washington, which I personally do not adhere to, sudden jihadi syndrome. And again, a quick outlook for the next 2 to 5 years as I personally see it. I think this is a very important quote here from Al-Suri, where he says, "Al-Qaeda is not an organization. It is not a group, nor do we want it to be. It is a call, a reference, a methodology." And I think this has long been the position of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda senior leadership, that they did want to have a global movement and not necessarily an organization per se, that as the military likes to have everything with a hierarchical structure, command and control, where we can pinpoint folks and know who's in charge and hit key critical elements. They would enjoy very much success if they're able to convey this information to their followers, that every individual is a member of Al-Qaeda who believes in Al-Qaeda's philosophy and theories. I'm going to quickly go through some of these historical attacks just because I think it shows in some ways, why Al-Qaeda is hampered by the success of 9/11. The first attack that in the West that we attribute to Al-Qaeda is the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. That was planned and executed by Ramzi Youssef, who was the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the mastermind of the second World Trade Center attacks. We were very fortunate in the first World Trade Center attack in the fact that they very well could have brought down the building with the explosives that they were using. It was just a matter of where they had placed the van inside the garage of the World Trade Center. And that was the only thing that saved us from a catastrophic incident that day. There were 6 dead, approximately 1,000 people wounded in the first World Trade Center attack. Took about 2 years of planning to be able to pull that operation off. And the interesting thing about that was they actually did not look at the World Trade Center as their first target. Their first target was the UN headquarters building. Even as far as the morning of the attack, they were planning to hit the UN headquarters, but security around UN headquarters was too tight. They weren't able to get the van in, and so they were able to redirect on short notice, go into the World Trade Center parking garage, and execute the attack from there. Shortly after that, the blind Sheikh Rahman, who was also peripherally involved with the first World Trade Center bombing, had a plot to blow up New York City landmines, simultaneous explosions throughout the city in an attempt to cause havoc that we've seen in some of their later attacks. Because of the first bombing, we were lucky in that there was increased scrutiny on Sheikh Rahman, which allowed the U.S. government to go in and move in on him and take down his cell and his folks before they were able to execute these attacks. So the number of casualties that would have occurred from there, both physical and psychologically to the U.S., was averted. In January 95, Ramzi Youssef again had a plot that he was planning on blowing up 11 trans-Pacific flights coming into the United States. They did a trial run. They executed it almost flawlessly. It was a very fortuitous fortuitous incidents why this plot was uncovered and why this plot, why even the practice run didn't succeed. And Ramzi Youssef is a hands-on guy, or was a hands-on guy. He actually was in the planning and in the operation of the World Trade Center, the first World Trade Center, and he actually was the person who placed the bomb on an Air Japan flight that was the test run. And what he had done was he had moved his seats numerous times during the flight, assembled the bomb on the plane in the restroom, placed it underneath the last seat that he was on the plane. He disembarked, I believe, in Osaka. The plane continued on to Tokyo, and an explosion occurred during the second leg after he was already off the plane. Fortuitous that he had not hit above the fuel tank, and it was only unique to this plane where the fuel tank was not where it should have been under their planning purposes. But because of that alerted the United States and some foreign governments into the plan, and they were able to take this plot down before it was executed. But had it been executed, you probably would have had a catastrophe that would have been greater than 9/11. Estimates of over 4,000 people could have been on the planes at the time of the explosions. And again, it would have had a massive psychological impact, which is an additional goal of all of these acts. I have Khobar Towers up here. Khobar Towers was not an Al-Qaeda attack. However, Khobar Towers was executed by an international Islamic terrorist group. And so I have that up there because I'm going to show you some casualty numbers and show you the impact either psychologically or monetarily or in terms of human life, what these attacks have done and how they've gradually become bigger, badder than the attacks before them. On August 8th, 1998 was actually my very first day as the senior duty officer in the White House Situation Room. Baptism under fire. Came in around 5 in the morning, We just got word probably around 4:30 that morning that we had 2 near simultaneous attacks on our embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. Again, those were an Al-Qaeda attack. They were planned and by Mohammed Atef, who is a leader in the operation side of Al-Qaeda. There were more than 200 deaths, I believe, and 3,000 injuries in this attack against sovereign U.S. Entities overseas. On 12 October 2000 was the USS Cole attack. This is the first time that Al-Qaeda went actually after a Defense Department, a symbol of America's defense power. And although there were the deaths and injuries were limited, the potential, there were close to 300 sailors on board that ship, the potential for a larger catastrophe fortunately was averted. And then, of course, that brings us up to September 11th, 2001, the attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the fourth plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. And there's still dispute over what the final target was, whether it was the Capitol or the White House itself. And we're all familiar with that attack. Okay. Again, just quickly, I'm going to show you the progression of the number of folks killed and Al-Qaeda's methodology. Again, Al-Qaeda always wants to make a bigger and badder impact than they did previously. The first World Trade Center, there were only six individuals killed. At Khobar Towers, there were 19. The U.S. embassies, there was close to 200 people killed. USS Cole, only 17. And then the World Trade Center, just under 3,000. World Trade Center, Pentagon, and Pennsylvania combined, close to 3,000 people killed. Injuries, again, you'll see the massive increase in injuries as you go forward. Out of those more than 6,000 people injured during September 11th, more than 2,000 were first responders on the scene who came to it. And then again, if you can just see how September 11th has dwarfed all the previous attacks, as bad and as catastrophic as they were to the United States, we've actually been blessed, I believe, as a result of the success they had, because again, they need to create greater impact in every event that they're responsible for. And in order to surpass what they were able to accomplish on September 11th, it's going to take a lot more planning than they had for September 11th, a lot more coordination, a lot more money, a lot more illegal financial and merchandise transfers, things that have been impeded since 9/11, as well as the fractured leadership that Al-Qaeda now suffers from. I'd like to highlight just three Al-Qaeda-inspired attacks, because again, these attacks were not perpetrated, they were not organized, they were not directed by Al-Qaeda leadership. They were all undertaken by individuals and groups of individuals in Europe to create catastrophic events because of just the inspirational leadership that they got from Al-Qaeda and from the worldwide Salafi terrorist movement. The first one was the Madrid train attacks. The folks who had perpetrated this act were recent immigrants to Spain. You had all across the economic and political spectrum, folks who were low-level criminals. Two of the folks had an ecstasy ring that they were running. Two of the folks had a small business that they were running. They had a cell phone business that was relatively successful. A few students that were studying in Spain. So it was a wide mix. It was not a way of profiling any of the individuals. Even doing a post-mortem of the attack, it's relatively impossible to do a post-mortem and profile who perpetrated this act, what type of person was most likely to become a terrorist and to be moved to action. Took them about 4 months to plan the attack. And it shows that a homegrown terrorist and a relatively low-tech attack can still do a lot of damage. Close to 200 people killed, 1,800 injured, and there's a direct effect on the Spanish elections. If you remember, the Spanish presidential elections were 3 days after the attacks, and they were designed to influence the Spanish population to vote out President Aznar's administration, who was supportive of the U.S. efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it worked. 3 days later, after the elections, President Eisenhower was out of a job, and a new administration, who was less supportive of the U.S. actions overseas, came into play. The first London tube bombings of July 7th, 2005, the individuals who did this attack, again, were three British citizens of Pakistani descent, born Muslims, and one Jamaican immigrant to the United Kingdom who was a convert during his high school years into Islam. This again had a catastrophic event in London. There was a large amount of casualties, hit at their economic infrastructure. Anybody who's ridden the tube in London knows that they're very well used. They're a major source of transportation. And again, it was directed again. The motivation behind this was to directed against Prime Minister Blair and his government's perceived sphere of influence with the United States and their actions in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Israel was also cited as one of the reasons for the attacks. Just 2 weeks to the day later, there was a second series of attacks in London on the tube stations as well. Eerily similar to the first September, the first attacks on the tube. Now these folks were recent immigrants from East Africa, some Somalis, an Ethiopian. They didn't meet the profile of the previous attacks. They didn't meet the profile of the folks in Madrid as well. They were perhaps influenced by, and I find this one interesting because all four of these folks were arrested and convicted. And these attacks have very, very little press reporting on them and very, very little open source information to gain from them. And they could have been equally as catastrophic. The reason that these attacks were not successful was that all the detonators for the bombs went off. The actual explosives didn't go off. And had they gone off, and it was just poor skill sets of the individuals who created the bombs, had they gone off, it would have been equally as disastrous as the first attacks. So these three attacks in Europe demonstrate the ability for homegrown, non-Al-Qaeda terrorists to strike in their homeland. They've got many advantages over foreign influenced or foreign-directed folks. They live in the country. They have freedom of movement within their country. They have a knowledge of their countries, so that they don't seem out of place in and around any of the places that they may be surveilling and planning to attack. Domestically, we've had numerous incidents of plots within the United States of similar homegrown terrorists who have attempted to have plots to disrupt the United States as well. I'm going to go through three of them here. I'll talk to you about a little bit about the people who perpetrated these plots, what the plots were themselves, what their motivations were to carry out these things, how they prepared, and again, what their downfalls were. How did the United States government come to know and disrupt the organizations that were planning these attacks? The first one, which I think has gotten a lot of press, is the Fort Dix plot. Here you had a group of six individuals, three Albanian brothers, recent immigrants, well, not too recent, immigrants from Macedonia, and a Turk and two Pakistanis who were lawful permanent residents of the United States. Their target was to shoot up a cluster of U.S. soldiers inside Fort Dix to protest the U.S. actions against Muslims worldwide. The way that they had planned this attack was they had done some preparation for it. They had gone to a shooting range in Pennsylvania, fired off some AK-47s, weapons, and had planned this thing. It was sort of interesting about these folks were, at one point, they all claimed that they wanted to be martyrs, and they all wanted to die in the attack, and it was going to be a suicide attack. And then at other points, they were all talking about how do we do this and get out before we're noticed and get off the base. So their commitment was, you know, depending on what day of the week it was, ended up becoming how committed they were to it. The interesting way that these folks were caught was when they were out at the Pennsylvania shooting range, they had videotaped this. And they had made some anti-U.S. remarks and some jihadi remarks that they were going to die for their country. They brought the tape to Circuit City and asked to have it converted to a DVD. And the store clerk at Circuit City was the one who alerted the FBI to the tape, the existence of the tape. FBI had a paid informant who was able to infiltrate the group, was responsible for selling them the weapons that led to the U.S. being able to arrest them and bring down this cell. Had this attack occurred, I don't think it would have been as catastrophic as some of the others. It was very, very low tech, low cost, not a lot of planning that went involved in it, and none of the folks who were involved in this were truly prepared to execute something of any magnitude above what their plot was. The second plot is by a man named Kevin James, who was a prisoner in the California penal system. What he had done was he had convinced two other African-American converts in the prison system to create this group called Jamiat ul-Islam Sahid. And they had one Pakistani legal permanent resident who was not a member of the prison cell. Sometimes you'll hear about these guys as the gang that couldn't shoot straight because their planning was horrific, their thought process was bad, and they never even got close to executing to be able to pull anything off. Their goal was to shoot up LAX airport, some U.S. Army recruiting stations in California, and some synagogues, and it was basically going to be a shooting spree. And they thought that by doing so that they would curry favor with some Pakistani extremist groups as well, and that they would get a name for themselves. But again, they are referred to as just a very, very poorly conceived, poorly organized group. Some of the mistakes that they made were numerous, including Kevin James sending letters from his prison cell with the plans on it to his folks who were out of prison. Their plan was to finance this operation by robbing gas stations. So they were going to rob a series of gas stations to come up with the money to be able to do this operation. And they were just, throughout the whole planning process, they were completely indiscreet about what it was that they were doing. They had no connections to Pakistani terrorist groups. They were just, it was just completely high school level planning and processing by these folks, and thankfully so. The most recent one is in May of this year, and this one was a little bit more complex and a little bit more thought process was placed into this. Again, similar to the LAX plot, you had three converts from the New York prison system who had converted to Islam while in prison, became a little bit more radicalized, had a bit of hatred against Jewish individuals and wanted to protest the U.S. Actions both in Israel and in the Middle East, per se. Their targets were two synagogues in the Bronx and an Air National Guard plane at Stewart Air National Guard Base in New York. Again, hoping to retaliate against U.S. actions in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as U.S. support for the State of Israel. These folks had actually been infiltrated by an FBI informant again, who was able to get into the group. And the FBI actually made the bombs and sold them an inert Stinger missile. They had everything that they needed to conduct this attack. The good news was that they bought everything from the FBI. Everything was inert. They had the plan was to lay the bombs at the two synagogues in the Bronx, drive up to Newburgh, New York, to the Air National Guard station, shoot down the plane, and simultaneously execute the bombs in the synagogues in New York City. Once they laid the bombs at the synagogue and they were moving on their way to Newburgh, the FBI came in, swarmed them, and made the arrests. So these folks were truly committed to committing this act. they were, you know, had the FBI not been able to infiltrate it, they probably would have come up with the equipment necessary to, you know, to conduct the attack and been able to go ahead and actually execute it. But again, luckily, a paid FBI informant was able to infiltrate the group and be able to help bring them down. They still have not gone to trial yet, so this is all alleged. Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about sudden jihad syndrome. Has anybody heard that term out here yet? Is that a term that's local? And I hope it's not. I actually hope it's not a term that gets popularized here. Because three of these folks here suffered from sudden jihadi syndrome. Three of these folks didn't. And if we go through these folks, I'll go through them relatively quickly, and we can decide, you know, later whether these folks are Islamic terrorists or they're just another psychologically depraved individual who wreaks havoc on his fellow citizens in the United States, no matter what his reasoning was. Now, their reasons may have been anti-American, they may have been pro-Islamic, but they were not terrorists in my eyes, per se. And I had a coming to heart of this when I was looking at the recent shooting down in Arkansas at the Little Rock recruiting station, because my first mindset was Carlos Bledsoe was a terrorist and he needed to be treated like a terrorist. Now I'm backing off of my original thought. The three folks up top, the first one is Carlos Bledsoe, Abdul Hakim Muhammad, who, if you remember in this year, he went through a Little Rock recruiting station, fired up the recruiting station, killed one recruiter's assistant and wounded another recruiter's assistant. He was on the lookout for U.S. military personnel to shoot. He was an angry young man who was upset about the U.S. treatment of Muslims worldwide, and he wanted to go out and kill American servicemen. Sounds like a terrorist. Well, we see some of these other shooting rampages. Maybe he's not a terrorist. Muhammad Reza Tahir Azar was a well-liked, very quiet, very studious, recent graduate of the University of North Carolina. When, to protest U.S. actions in the Middle East, he drove a rented Jeep Cherokee through the pit at North Carolina and rammed into seven individuals, injured seven people, none of them seriously, drove right out of the pit, called the police and turned himself in and said, you know, this is what I've done and this is why I've done it. And he was, again, taken into custody and is serving a very, very long prison sentence. Navid Azal Haq is from the Pacific Northwest, was a very intelligent young man, 31 years old, University of Pennsylvania Medical School, ended up dropping out, got his degree in computer science up at Washington State. His problem was had a series of history of depression, anxiety issues where he couldn't find a girlfriend, and that was his main concern, was that he wasn't able to connect with people, wasn't able to connect with women. He actually had, his father is a leading cleric, Muslim cleric in the Pacific Northwest, very moderate cleric. Navid actually converted to Christianity about a year before the shootings, and then reconverted back to being a Muslim. And his crime was he went into the Jewish Federation Center in Seattle, Washington, armed with an AK-47, killed one woman, critically wounded another, and wounded about six other females in the organization. During the siege, when he was talking to the 911 operators, he said, "I am doing this because I am an Islam. I am a Muslim, and I am upset with." The Israelis and their treatment their sphere of influence in the United States. So again, three folks who committed attacks on U.S. soil against U.S. citizens, and their reasoning was that they were upset with the U.S. actions and the U.S. sphere of influence in the Middle East. But how do they differ so much from Sang-Hui Cho, who was the Virginia Tech shooter? A similar intelligence level to Hark. A loner like Hawk was, unable to get a girlfriend or keep a girlfriend, relationship problems, being treated for depression, very, very similar to Hawk. And he acted out against his fellow students at Virginia Tech, who he perceived was his enemy, his personal enemy. Robert A. Hawkins, who I believe everybody's familiar with here in the Omaha area, a young 19-year-old man who went into a mall in Omaha and fired up a bunch of shoppers just prior to Christmas 2 years ago. Again, had very, very troubled psychological past. He was in and out of trouble with the law. He had moved to a foster home, was a ward of the state of Nebraska for 3 years, and he was just angry at the world. Was recent breakup with his girlfriend, tried to join the U.S. Army, but his ASVAB scores were too low, and decided that he was going to go out, and he was going to go out with a bang, and he was going to take as many people with him as he could. Once again, you know, a person who has a perceived enemy that he wants to take out and is going to take him out with him. And the final guy is George Sodini, who is the gentleman earlier this year who went into the LA Fitness Club in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, went into the aerobic studio and just turned off the lights and started shooting indiscriminately at a bunch of women who were taking an aerobics class. George had a blog on a website for over a year detailing his plan and his anger at women, what he was going to do, why he was going to do it, and how he was going to do it. And we weren't able to, you know, the law enforcement people in the Pennsylvania area were not able to see this or take action against him. And so I bring these three non-Islamic terrorists folks up here with the three folks who are being termed as suffering from sudden jihadi syndrome as kind of a comparison. Personally, to me, I don't see the top three folks as Islamic terrorists, Islamic homegrown threat, any more than I see a school shooter, a workplace violence gentleman, a domestic violence person who shoots up his entire family, as just a criminal, a person who has psychological problems, who definitely needs attention to these problems. Many of them are on medication. Many of them have been in and out of the system. And they've perpetrated acts against their perceived enemy. I'm more than willing to listen to anybody who has a different opinion on that, because it's just something, again, that I've just formulated over the last couple of months, especially looking at the incident in Arkansas, because I was personally upset when the incident happened and there was no White House statement, there was no statement from the Department of Defense, and I thought, we've just had an act of terrorism inside the United States directed against U.S. military members, and nobody's saying a word, you know. And that was my first thought when it happened. Afterwards, you know, in doing some reading on other folks who had committed similar acts, my mindset kind of started to change, and I thought, you know what, maybe these folks aren't terrorists, you know. Maybe they're just like any other of these rampage shooters who have gone through and committed acts of violence. The New York Police Department and the FBI have done a really, really good job on identifying the radicalization process. What takes a person, as I said earlier, from being a student at Bellevue University to being moved to action against their perceived enemy? And here I'm talking mainly about groups of individuals such as the Fort Dix folks, the LAX folks, and the New York Synagogue bomb plots. Clusters of individuals with a like-minded goal, who have done planning, who have done organizational preparation, and have been moved to action. And they've come through a four-step process of pre-radicalization, identification, indoctrination, and action. I'll go through each of these individually. One of the things that the New York Police Department says, and I believe they lifted that from somebody else. I'll have to research that source. But they said there are no profiles. You cannot profile these individuals and say this is the type of individual who is going to commit who is going to be moved to action and commit a terrorist attack against the United States. However, every case study they looked at, the folks had a similar trajectory where they've gone through these gates and went to action. And the New York Police Department identifies this as a funnel. You know, not everybody who goes in to the pre-radicalization stage comes out a terrorist on the other end. It funnels down, and you know, but if they are moved to action, then they've gone through all the gates that all the other folks who have moved to action have. As far as the pre-radicalization age, most of these folks have lived an unremarkable life. They've had little or no connection with law enforcement. They've not been in and out of systems. They've not risen to the level of where folks are looking at them. Of course, the two of the three incidences I showed you were prison converts. But for the most part, folks who have moved to action have not been have not lived a remarkable life where folks have taken notice of them throughout their lives and been able to say, you know, I could see that happening with him, you know, from his childhood through his adulthood. They're either a convert or they've had a reawakening of faith through some personal experience. Most of them were middle class. As far as the reawakening of the faith, they tended to be second or third generation American citizens who have tried to reconnect with their faith and became just prior to radicalization. And they tended to be more educated, at least to high school. Most of them had college schoolwork, at least, if not a degree. During the identification phase, these individuals, they accept the movement to the cause. They understand that that we need to take action in some way, and not physical action. It could be through politicization of their beliefs, but they're going to move through the next gate. And often there's a trigger in their life that moves them from being the identification phase, moving them over into the next phase, be it economic, losing a job, social, some of the same things that we have seen in some of the other folks, the school shooters and whatnot, alienation, discrimination, racism, political reasons and personal reasons, be it either a death of a close family member or incarceration or things of that nature that may cause them to move to being indoctrinated. Interesting, the indoctrination phase, during this phase, that's when they start to identify in groups and in clusters. A lot of folks will look at the mosques and say, okay, the mosque is where it happens. It doesn't need to be a mosque. It could be the student union. It could be an internet chat room. It can be a coffee house. But you're going to start to see these folks cluster in groups and individuals clustering in groups that are going to have like-mindedness, and the group think process starts to take over, where they feed off of each other and they become more radicalized. They end up withdrawing from the mosque, and there's two arguments as to why they withdraw from the mosque. One is that they perceive that if they get moved to action, the FBI has infiltrated every mosque in the United States, and therefore their association with the mosque could raise their personal awareness to the FBI. The other argument is that as they become more and more radical in their beliefs and their thoughts, they actually believe the mosque and even the folks who have brought them through the first two stages are not radical enough, don't know true Islam. Sort of like folks who quit smoking, you know, converts to a religion tend to be more fervorous. I mean, they've actually made a personal decision to learn more, to seek out more, and they become more fervent in their beliefs than folks who were raised in their religion as well. So they tend to become more radical than the mosque, more radical than the imam that may have been guiding them through their awakening in the religion or their conversion to the religion. They begin to start politicizing their beliefs. You might see that in community action. You might start seeing that in handing out pamphlets at a university, protests. They will start politicizing their beliefs to their family, to their friends, to strangers. You'll begin to see that. And then again, they believe that action is required to support that cause. And then finally, move to action. And this is the stage when they are terrorists. They are actively engaging in extremist activities, be it through facilitation, recruitment, financing, and they're going through all the stages of preparation, planning, and execution of an attack against the United States. Again, these are the four phases of radicalization as folks move through the system and become more and more radicalized. You cannot profile them. You can't say that it's going to be a Muslim male, 18 to 25 years old, with a college degree and a wife and two kids. They come from all economic backgrounds. They come from all social backgrounds. They come from all races, current converts, lifelong Muslims. And they actually, go through these phases, and at the end, they come out a terrorist. Again, not everybody who enters the phase exits the phase, but they do have the ability that they have been able to identify these four gates as gates that folks go through. Which brings us to the outlook, the next 2 to 5 years. Where do we see the bigger threat inside the United States to the homeland, to the heartland? Is it from Al-Qaeda, or is it from these groups and pockets of individuals who have been inspired by and motivated by Al-Qaeda to take action? I think as far as Al-Qaeda is concerned, it's going to be very difficult for them to surpass 9/11. Right now, their senior leadership is fractured. The original attacks that I showed you at the beginning of the presentation, all of the folks who were the masterminds behind that are either in prison or dead. So they've lost a lot of that level of management, operational planning, operational execution, direction, and guidance is out. The rest of Al-Qaeda senior leadership is hunkered down. They're providing messages and inspiration, but they're not providing the funding, they're not providing the direction, they're not providing the planning and execution. Obviously, since September 11th, we have increased our vigilance against illegal movement of individuals, illicit financial transactions. We've hardened up our borders. We've got a robust intelligence capability that we're executing against Al-Qaeda. And we're making it harder for them to plan and execute something of the magnitude of September 11th. Al-Qaeda is not going to attack the United States with a car bomb at Safeway or Giant or Target. They're not going to do that. And so in that way, you know, as I said earlier, it seems strange to say, but we were actually a little bit blessed by their success on September 11th, because they're going to need to outdo September 11th, and that's going to be awfully hard to do in the environment that they're operating in and the environment that we've set up here in the homeland to be able to do that. I am not going to say that it is impossible for them to do that, and I pray that it doesn't happen, but I don't believe that Al-Qaeda in the next 2 to 5 years is going to be able to do anything of the magnitude of September 11th, and anything less than the magnitude of September 11th will just show that they're a weakened organization as a hierarchy. However, they will continue to provide inspiration to others to act. There'll still be the occasional message from al-Zawahiri. There'll be propaganda videos that you'll see about U.S. troop involvement in Afghanistan, the drone attacks in Pakistan, U.S. support for the State of Israel. And we're not in any way going to be out of Afghanistan anytime soon. And despite what has been said about the withdrawal from Iraq, there will still be a large number of U.S. troops in advisory roles in Iraq for the foreseeable future. And even after we leave, if the state of Iraq is not a functioning state, it will also be perceived that it's not a functioning state because of the U.S. actions and what we have done inside Iraq to destabilize the country from, you know, what was, you know, a relatively stable country when Saddam Hussein was running it. The other thing I'd like to say, which I should have said up front in my disclaimer, is this briefing was all about Islamic terrorists. I understand that you've got folks on the left and on the right, societies of America, who are capable and have committed terrorist attacks inside the homeland. Aside from the September 11th attacks, the Environmental Liberation Front has caused more monetary damage to the United States than anybody else. The Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 created more deaths inside the United States than anybody besides Al-Qaeda. So there are other terrorist threats to the United States. This briefing was limited just to Islamic, homegrown, Al-Qaeda sympathizers, Al-Qaeda inspired individuals. So I'm going to conclude my remarks here. I believe we're going to take about a 15-minute break or so, and then we'll come back for Q&A discussion purposes. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We have heard a talk by Anthony Campanella, Vice President for Intelligence Programs at CMX Technologies. He spoke on the topic, The State of Security in the Heartland and Beyond, Assessing the Homeland Threat. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday morning, September 11, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jim Maxwell, Assistant Director of Public Relations at Bellevue University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.